This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. Well, we've all had to, of course, deal with the pandemic, and we keep remembering that teachers and youth workers are very, very important in any time, but the pandemic and more so in trying to create an affirming and supportive environment for our young people. And that's the topic of this month's discussion from Tammy Silverman, who's the president and CEO of the Indiana Youth Institute. And Tammy, thanks for joining us to talk about it today.
Always my pleasure. Glad to be here, Chris.
Well, you have some stats listed in the column, and maybe we should mention here first, because this is LGBTQ History Month, and there's a bit of history, I guess, in all of this, isn't there?
Absolutely, absolutely. And one of the things that we're highlighting this month is the impact that educators have on ensuring that our students who identify as LGBTQ feel protected and empowered.
And we have, what, about 43,000 youth in the state that identify as LGBTQ plus, I guess? I think maybe some people don't even realize there are that many.
Right. And those are ages 13 to 17. And those are the students who have reported identifying as LGBTQ plus. So there's probably more. We're fairly certain there are more. But you're right. Even that number might be something that folks didn't realize.
I know that, and it's also a problem, too, that we can discuss as well, the fact that there are many youth out there who are hesitant to identify as LGBTQ plus because of the stigma that is still out there that may identify with them.
Absolutely, absolutely. And actually, sadly, 2 out of 3 Indiana LGBTQ students have heard family or friends make negative comments that are directed towards their identity. And so therefore that might, you know, obviously that affects how they feel and how their feeling of protectedness and, comfort.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's really important. Again, one of the things we do know is that because students spend so much time at school surrounded by teachers, counselors, all the support staff, all of those folks, that often our LGBTQ students look to school for a source of understanding, caring, and support.
I know that IYI's recently put out a three-part series of data reports about LGBTQ plus youth in schools. And if you want to bring up some of the highlights that you note, we'd appreciate hearing about them.
Yes. Again, that series includes LGBT youth in schools. It also includes LGBT youth in foster care, as well as in the juvenile justice system, because unfortunately, in each of those settings, there's a lot more work that we need to be doing to make sure that we're including and supporting these students, because we know that kids that are in positive school climates, they're at lower risk of suicide. They also have fewer depressive symptoms. They also are more likely to stay in school, less days of skip school or skip classes, and there's lower dropout rates. So the benefits of providing that caring environment are very substantial.
I also know, too, that it's beyond what the IYI offers in information, but also that the Indiana State Teachers Association and their national group, the National Education Association, are helping to work with students and as well as parents and teachers that may have youngsters that identify as LGBTQ+, so that they are getting the support they need to keep on going.
Absolutely, absolutely. And both, as you just said, Chris, ISTA and the National Education Association have great tools and trainings on their websites that anyone can download, be it a teacher, educator, or a parent or family member or friend or coach or any of that. They have a lot of good resources out there, because you might feel like that's something you want to do. You want to make sure that you're providing a supportive, caring environment for a youth who identifies as LGBTQ, but you might not know. You might want some extra reinforcements or information or tools to do that.
I know that the part of the problem that LGBTQ plus students face, besides the biases that are out there, and harassment for that matter, but they're also facing bullying. And I know that is a big concern. And some reports come out and say that Indiana is not very high on the number of states that are dealing with the problem of bullying. What's the IYI trying to do to help encourage teachers and family members to fight this?
Well, fortunately, many schools are or already have intentionally built policies against harassment, bullying, you know, all of those kinds of things. And again, we want to keep celebrating the ones that have done that work, support the ones that are in the process of doing it, and encourage those schools who may not have taken that step yet to do so. Because we know that, again, students, we want all students, but particularly the students that are facing the greatest bullying or harassment, to have a safe environment so that they can learn and grow and thrive. So we know in many cases school staff are already those critical allies, and the kids report that, which is a positive.
Are we going to be finding maybe more data that comes out in the next big data book that comes out here at the end of this year, early of 2022, to talk about the problems that LGBTQ plus students and family and teachers are facing these days?
Absolutely. This is a little bit of a foreshadowing. So, you know, thank you for bringing that up, Chris. You know, one of the bright spots is that we know that 97% of students who identify as LGBTQ plus report having that supportive school staff member. And more than half, 55%, say they have a network of six or more supportive educators. So that's a really strong positive component. Again, we just need to make sure that all the students have that same supportive network in their schools and ideally throughout their communities and all the activities that they're engaging in.
Tammy Silverman, thank you very much for helping us out with the information, and we hope that we can continue to let people know about the concerns that the Indiana Youth Institute has, especially when they deal with the issues that affect most Hoosier young people, and that includes the LGBTQ plus community out there.
Always a pleasure. Thank you, Chris.
Tammy Silverman's the president and CEO of the Indiana Youth Institute, an Indiana-based financial assistance organization able to bring in help to more minority-owned small businesses with a $125,000 boost from the U.S. Treasury. Community Investment Fund of Indiana, or CIFI, has a local office in Hammond, and the fund's executive director, Phil Black, says that they get help from the Small Business Development Corporation here in Lake County to help locate businesses and to be able to channel loans to them.
Community Investment Fund of Indiana, we call it CIFI for short, is a catalyst for strengthening Indiana communities, empowering the underserved by leveraging partnerships to provide access to capital and critical development services. We are a certified community development financial institution. That program is housed in the Department of Treasury, and we make small business loans in all 92 counties. And we also make microloans, which are loans up to $50,000, and we provide development services to all our clients.
I understand that the CIFI has been helping organizations all across the state in urban as well as suburban locations, rural locations, I should say.
That's correct. Yes, absolutely.
What kinds of services and in turn businesses have been able to take advantage of these assistance funds that have been made available?
Certainly, I can give you some general descriptions.
Okay.
We have, you know, everything from construction to manufacturing. We have in Lake County a shopping mall that's going up there in the Miller Beach area, and that'll hold an additional eight businesses in the bays at once that's constructed.
Mm-hmm. I understand that a big portion of some of the local portfolio goes to help businesses of not only of color, but also businesses that are owned by women and Hispanics. Has it been very difficult for them in the past until now, until CIFI can help out, to be able to get these businesses going?
Well, in fact, one of the other programs we offer, in addition to those offered by the Department of Treasury, is a capacity building program specially designed in partnership with Lake County Economic Development Department. And we provide business technical assistance. And for a limited time under COVID-19, we provided $5,000 grants to those businesses that could work toward developing a plan that they could use after COVID-19 or as we move away from that nexus.
Have we found over time that many of these businesses that have gotten this assistance have either not been able to or have made it very, very difficult to be able to go to traditional financing, to the banks or to savings and loans and the like to be able to get the funds that they need?
Yes, sir. We certainly partner with all the banks in Indiana, and we make they make referrals to us, and we can take applications online, and then we start working with the customers. But often it's a customer that may have something that is challenging for a traditional lending institution to make a loan to them, such as maybe it's a startup, maybe it's a startup, or maybe it's an existing business without a financial track record, or they could be in a risky sector such as construction or restaurants.
We're talking with Phil Black. He's the Executive Director of the Community Investment Fund of Indiana, CIFI. They're based in Indianapolis, and they also have an operation in Hammond. Now, Phil, if you will, tell us more about the funds that the U.S. Treasury is helping make available to create, I guess, better opportunities for minority businesses to be able to look for the funds they need.
Sure. We recently received Community Development Financial Program Technical Assistance Award. It's $125,000. And the Department of Treasury competitively awards those CDFIs that are serving low-income and underserved communities, and that they're lacking resources that SciFi can provide. And so this is right on the heels of a $1.538 million award that was supportive economic relief in communities affected by COVID-19. And so we'll use those programs in combination to use with our existing resources to make more loans available in Lake County and to loans available in their surrounding counties.
Okay. Are there a lot of businesses that have been waiting for this additional funds? Is there a backlog of applications, so to speak?
We have an online process, and we try to process their inquiries and applications as quickly as possible. We think that there are more businesses out there that maybe are not aware of our programming, and that will certainly be applying as a result of talking with you today.
That's great. Now, if anybody's interested, any small businesses in particular that meet the guidelines of the CIFI funding might want to check out more, how can they find out that?
Well, certainly they can contact us over our website at capitalizingindiana.org. That's capitalizingindiana.org. Or they can phone us at 317-960-3710, or they can reach us at our Hammond office at 219-803-6553.
That's Community Investment Fund of Indiana Executive Director Phil Black. You're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. A member of a state energy task force wants Indiana to study whether rooftop solar benefits the electric company's utility customers. But Indiana Public Broadcasting's Rebecca Thiel reports that the co-chairs of the task force say they won't make that recommendation to the legislature.
The Indiana Energy Association says because people with solar panels get paid for excess energy they deliver to the grid, they're paying less for infrastructure costs and essentially getting subsidized by other customers. But Democratic Representative Matt Pierce says rooftop solar provides other perks for customers that often get left out.
You didn't really consider the benefits to that non-solar ratepayer of perhaps avoiding the construction of a new power plant.
At least 10 states have conducted similar studies on the value of rooftop solar, and most found all utility customers benefit from it. But Task Force co-chair Ed Soliday questioned whether the study would be objective. Pierce also suggested the task force reiterate that the legislature hasn't changed how it calculates excess energy solar customers deliver to the grid, an issue that's being debated in court. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Rebecca Thiel.
Jesse Carbonda has been the executive director of the Hoosier Environmental Council for almost 14 years now, when he took over in charge of the largest environmental policy group in Indiana. And he has told his staff and other members, too, and his board of directors that he is going to be looking to the future. In fact, he's going to be stepping down as the executive director over time. And the search will be to find another executive director of the HEC. But we have him with us today to talk about what's ahead for him, as well as what he's been doing with the HEC over the years. Jesse, thank you very much for spending time with us today here on Regionally Speaking.
Thank you, Chris. It's always good to be with you.
Well, I always get a kick out of having a chance to talk with you. Of course, it's more exciting during the legislative sessions. I get a little little emotional at times, I know, but that's the way that the industry is these days. They bring a lot of emotions out in not only supporters, but even some detractors of the environment. But we're always glad to have you with us to talk about things. First, if I may, let me ask, what is in the future for Jesse Carbondo? What are you like to do in the months ahead once you get to step down from the Hoosier Environmental Council?
Well, thank you so much, Chris. And it's, again, been such a pleasure to be on your show over the years. And you know, running the Hoosier Environmental Council has been the honor of my life, and there is so much challenge yet to address. But I've been feeling a calling recently to really begin to focus my energies on the extinction crisis and the fact that our society here in America and globally is so addicted to factory farming. And so I'd like to channel my energies to addressing these two extraordinary challenges and to do so through writing, and hope that this provides a platform to then be able to speak about these issues across the country to try to change people's consciousness about the fact that, you know, we are in an extinction crisis that we haven't seen in 65 million years, and that factory farming is causing an innumerable array of problems in terms of the brutality to animals. We lose 70 billion land mammals, land animals each year across the world. And it has all sorts of effects on our own health, on the health of animals, on our environment. So I'd like to really focus on these extraordinary issues of our time.
What are you thinking that you would like to do? Would you like to do some writing? Would you like to do some other advocacy work?
Right. Well, I think it will be the form of writing to begin with. And then once again, hopefully that provides me a new platform to really talk about these issues across the country and be able to really lift up the amazing array of organizations that do already exist in America so that we can get more of the public engaged. I think, you know, we spend too much time in terms of the public discourse on things that really don't matter when we really need to put the public's attention on the things that do. And among them is the fact that our planet is still suffering these extraordinary problems, even with the extraordinary number of talented people. And we need to marshal more of the talent of the American people towards addressing these extraordinary crises.
I know you've spent an awful lot of your time here with the HEC dealing with the problems we have in Indiana, a lot of them because of centering around pollution, actually. I guess with Indiana ranking pretty high among the most polluted states in the country. But I know you've always been working for positive change, and I know a lot of what's the Hoosier Environmental Council has been able to do has been able to work toward positive change and making the Indiana environment a little cleaner, a little safer for everybody to live and to work in. Will you take a time and go think back over the last few years, certainly, but maybe even longer if you choose, about some of the things that you've been able to help the Hoosier Environmental Council do over the last more than a decade?
Thank you for the question, Chris. You know, it is nothing we could accomplish could be done without extraordinary partners and extraordinary members across the state in partnership with foresighted lawmakers and other elected officials. You know, from a legislative perspective, what stands out to me as the biggest achievements is defeating legislation that, had it gone through, would have methodically dismantled our ability to address statewide environmental problems and would have also tied the hands of local governments to address certain environmental problems. So I think the biggest category of achievement that the environmental movement has secured, for which HEC, Hoosier Environmental Council, has played a very important role, is stopping things from getting worse and giving our state government and local governments the continued authority to address persistent environmental problems. You know, looking at this a little bit more narrowly, we can talk to organizing victories that we've had in different parts of the state. You know, when I think about Northwest Indiana, I think about our efforts to work with local groups to successfully block a factory farm from being built on the outskirts of El Paraiso. I think about the lawsuit that we are currently continuing to pursue with the Environmental Law and Policy Center to try to hold ArcelorMittal, now Cleveland Cliffs, accountable for the pollution it caused a couple of years ago. I think about the partnerships we've had with environmental justice groups in East Chicago and in Gary to hold polluters accountable where their burden, where they are causing a great burden of suffering on low-income communities, communities that are often communities of color.
Mm-hmm.
So that's just a broad sweep of kind of the impact I think we've had.
Do you think that even though it's not been as quite as successful as you would like to, as speaking for the Hoosier Environmental Council, would like to it to be, do you think that the General Assembly has been able to make some moves over the last few sessions to try to make things better, even though not everything has gotten passed or even been introduced?
Yes. Well, I think that, again, when I think about the impact that we've had in the legislature, it has most of all been to try to stop things from getting worse. And that itself is an achievement. But in terms of progressive policy, you know, I think about working with Lake County lawmakers to pass a bill to require lead testing in schools. That was a very positive, proactive achievement. I think about the enactment of a mass transit law that currently applies to central Indiana, but it's something that we've been pressing to make statewide, which empowers local governments to be able to enact a local transit tax that allows them to facilitate the growth of buses and bus rapid transit and other mass transit technologies. I think about the progress that we made last decade to significantly increase investment in rooftop solar and energy efficiency that unfortunately the legislature dismantled a few years after those achievements. So we do see signs of very meaningful progress, but we need to marshal a lot more Hoosiers to get invested in the endeavor of talking to their lawmakers on a very consistent basis, to build relationships with those lawmakers, even when it seems frustrating because the lawmaker has a very different worldview than we might. You know, we've just got to be persistent, even though the terrain in the legislature is unquestionably very hard.
Do you think that the part of the effort that you've been able to accomplish and continue to accomplish, because you're not done with the job yet with the Hoosier Environmental Council, is to making sure that the coalitions get built and they stay in place so that you get the wide of diversity of people, of organizations, of political leaders involved in dealing with the environment?
Absolutely, Chris. You know, I think one of the hallmarks I would like to think of my leadership of HEC over these almost 14 years is this persistent commitment to building the tent and drawing in people of faith who obviously represent the majority of Hoosiers, and to draw in authentically green-minded businesses, to draw in young people for whom the climate crisis is foremost in their minds. So I think what gives me hope in the midst of this very difficult landscape in the legislature is the fact that there are so many constituencies in Indiana that we have yet to marshal. We've certainly made progress, but we have yet to marshal. And, you know, one of the priorities that I've especially emphasized these last few years that I hope my success will continue, Chris, is to really build our footprint in rural Indiana because we do have a robust urban environmental justice program in Indianapolis, one that we would like to revive in Northwest Indiana. But we also have to keep in mind that there are really systemic environmental justice issues in rural Indiana, where groundwater, where drinking water wells mm-hmm. are under threat from an array of factors, whether that's leaking landfills or factory farms or coal ash waste pits or agrochemicals seeping into our ground.
Do you think that's when the real emphasis has changed a bit from urban to rural, when the issues of factory farms and problems with coal ash disposal have come about, and that's really gotten the attention lately?
Well, I think we've got to work in tandem. I mean, I think that both urban communities and rural communities in different ways bear great burdens of environmental pollution. You know, in in urban Indiana, of course, Northwest Indiana foremost comes to mind, and what happens in East Chicago and Gary, where there are, you know, hundreds of hazardous waste sites and hundreds of underground storage tanks and dozens of Superfund sites. So, you know, we have to keep our eye on just the reality that these poor communities are bearing so much of a pollution burden. But at the same time, we have to appreciate again that low-income rural communities also bear a great burden, again, because so much industry gets concentrated there.
Well, Jesse, do you think that now that your board of directors is off on their own task in helping to look for a successor for the position, you think that it's just kind of getting things together and helping whoever comes in to be able to take over early next year?
Well, you know, I think life will continue the same for the next few months, most notably because next month, Chris, we will be hosting Greening the State House.
That's right.
Which will be, for the second year in a row, a virtual event, again, with the recognition that the Delta variant remains very much out there and there are breakthrough infections. And so we hope all of our friends in Northwest Indiana can join us for that. That event is at heckweb.org/GTS. And it's an opportunity for people to, again, continue to be replenished with knowledge about the pressing issues facing Indiana, and also to be very prepared for the 2022 legislative session, which will be here before we know it. And we'll be having a panel discussion, I might add, Chris, expressly focused on how we can think of a new paradigm for Northwest Indiana, Southwest Indiana, which, again, regionally speaking, have borne such a burden of pollution.
Well, Jesse, we'll have a chance to talk again very soon, it looks like, with the Greening the State House coming up and a lot of other things yet to come for the Hoosier Environmental Council. And we thank you for spending time with us to talk about what's happened so far with the Hoosier Environmental Council and look at what may happen again soon. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Chris.
For more than two decades, residents near a waste oil recycling facility in Indianapolis have had issues with residents having frequent headaches, hives, irritated lungs, and not to mention the odor. The Indiana Department of Environmental Management says proposed changes at the Metalworking Lubricants Company may reduce pollution. But Indiana Public Broadcasting's Rebecca Thiel tells us that residents around there are skeptical that anything will change.
Metalworking Lubricants has had several violations in recent years. Five of the company's operating tanks are releasing pollution directly into the air. Among other things, IDEM wants to hook those up to the plant's scrubber to control their emissions. Jed Fuller lives near the plant and works for a neighborhood ministry called Impact Old Southside. He says many of the lower-income families he serves don't speak out as often about the pollution that affects their everyday lives.
They don't trust the institutions that are in place to actually do something for them because so oftentimes they have not been treated well by those institutions.
Odor from the plant can smell like a natural gas leak, which has led to false reports and concerns that residents used to the smell might not recognize a real one. An IndyStar investigation found the city of Indianapolis signed an agreement with the company to stop operating during Super Bowl 46, likely to lessen the smell for visitors. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Rebecca Thiel.
And that's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Coming up tomorrow, we have Reporters Roundtable Thursday, and Post-Tribune Lake County Government reporter Alex Kukulka will join us, as well as a Times Business reporter Joseph Pete to talk about the stories they've put out in print and online, as well as a tribute to the life and legacy of gymnast Diane Durham. There will be a celebration of life for her coming up this next week. And thanks for joining us today. Back with you tomorrow.